recorded live in Farmer Hall in the high center amidst the community of educators here at Messiah College. This is the Wave Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. Now, your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome to this special episode, a bonus episode of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. Most of our listeners thought that season four was over, Drew, but we are here, and we are in front of a live audience today. Let's hear it. Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, this feels a little bit different. Usually we're in the cozy confines of a recording studio here around the corner, but I think we can make this work. But I do hear grades were due, an hour ago?
Hour or so ago.
And we had commencement rained out again, so maybe this is a live audience, but maybe not a lively audience.
That's definitely true. Let's hear it again from our live studio audience, right? Yeah! No, is this the part where I say, I can't hear you, right? Louder, right? I'm surprised at how lively everybody is. I should make sure everybody understands. We are recording a live episode right now. This will be edited and it will be distributed out on all of our podcatchers, which is a word I learned from you, iTunes, Stitcher, and so forth. So you are participating as a live audience in a live recorded episode. So we are here for Educators Day, a tradition in which our faculty and other educators mark the end of the previous year and turn our attention to developing ourselves for the year ahead.
So you're saying this is required?
Absolutely, this is required. The provost is sitting over here to my right. And you know something? That's a good transition for today's topic, Drew. What is required of us as academics to flourish in a digital world? Drew, would you say that you flourish in a digital world?
Well, I like to call it the world.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. Good point. This is really a generational question, isn't it? In my case, my graduate school, I was just talking with Ashley Schaefer, my graduate school in earliest years as a faculty member predated social media, digital scholarship, etc. So as a grad student yourself, who's pursuing a PhD in early American history at Lehigh, as well as a husband and a father, do you experience challenges because our world is so pervasively technological?
Definitely. I think somewhere back there is our intern. Those of you who listen to the podcast,
there,
my 2-year-old daughter is our official intern, Nilsa. I think she's probably somewhere back there.
Hey, Nilsa.
Back there on
waving.
Is she waving? Oh, yay! She's probably back there on a screen watching Netflix or using the old iPad. Babysitter. And we tried really hard as parents to kind of limit screen time. You know, they say kids shouldn't be in front of a screen until a certain age. But, I mean, it's so hard because they're everywhere, and I'm using screens all the time, and so she wants to see. I mean, she knows how to get through my phones or my photos on my phone much more easily than I am. But on the other hand, I think it presents us with a lot of wonderful opportunities. In fact, one of my advisors at Lehigh, he's a recent hire. He's a young guy. He just finished his PhD 5 or 6 years ago, and already he comments all the time, looking at my own scholarship, about how much easier it is for me to access archives and do my work just because all of these tools are available to me digitally.
Yeah. Someone who was actually reading some 18th century letters last night online, I could definitely kind of relate to that. You know, by having a blog, I've been accountable to get my ideas out there in a very short period of time. At the same time, because I follow a lot of historians on their blogs and on Twitter, I also get kind of cutting-edge scholarship, cutting-edge stuff that's being put out there.
Do you face challenges in your own work?
Well, you know, I think my dreams are now take place in 280 characters, right? I mean, they're limited to 280 characters.
I did notice you were quick to use the increased character limit when they rolled that out on Twitter. You can tell you're a historian when, I got to use up all the space.
I got 140 more. Seriously, though, Twitter has become a very effective way of communicating history-related ideas. So much so that we actually titled episode 34 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home, Twitterstorians, and we featured Princeton University historian Kevin Cruz. This is the king of the Twitterstorians. He has over 50,000 followers. Among many other things, Twitter historians have brought accurate history to the internet.
Yeah, actually, our audience might find that podcast episode of interest, and I assume many of us here are not yet listeners. So if you actually want to just search for The Way of Improvement Leads Home on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcatcher of choice, you can even give the podcast a 5-star review while you're there. For those in the audience new to the podcasting medium, basically 50% of my job is begging people for 5-star reviews.
That's right.
So the Twitterstorian episode really focused on the discipline of history. In what ways do you think academics in a digital world influences other disciplines?
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about history here so far, right? And that's a great question. And that is the focus of our panel today. We have three guests today. Have we had three guests before? We've had three.
We've had two, but I think it's our first three.
Yeah, one is a fellow historian, another is in English, and a third is from communication. And we will be exploring how our digital world influences their work as academics. So, Drew, why don't you tell us a little bit about our panel for today?
Gladly. And let's welcome to the Palmer stage our three panelists this morning. As I introduce each one, let's give them a roaring applause because we're trying to get some compelling audio here, and we want to get that crowd noise in the recording. So let's first welcome David Pettigrew, Associate Professor of History at Messiah College. David.
Welcome, David.
Dr. Pettigrew is a scholar of the ancient Mediterranean world who uses material evidence and digital tools to write and produce regional histories. As an archaeologist and historian, David has participated in and directed archaeological research programs in the United States, Greece, and Cyprus, and authored articles and books on Greek and Roman cities and landscapes. As a digital historian, David manages blogs, websites, and interactive historical maps, and coordinates digital humanities activities here at Messiah. He is currently involved in research on the archaeology of early Christianity and the excavations of ancient coastal sites in Cyprus and developing the Digital Harrisburg Initiative. He blogs at CorinthianMatters.com and tweets at CorinthianMatters. Our next guest is Dr. Gene Corey, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of English, as well as the Director. As well as the director for the Center for Public Humanities here at Messiah College. Her research centers on justice and pedagogy, gender and literacy. There are a few things Dr. Jean Corey loves more than good conversation, which is why she loves to teach English. Her love for generative conversation also equips her well as director of the Center for Public Humanities, a center devoted to kindling the conversation regarding the capacity of the humanities to transform individual lives through the discovery of meaning and to transform society through the discovery of shared civic ideals. To realize its goals, the center sponsors innovative forms of public humanities outreach, including Poetry in Place, the Hoverter course in the humanities, and the Humanities Fellows, whose blog can be followed at humanitiesinplace@wordpress.com. Our third and final guest is Nathan Skolstad, who serves as Assistant Professor of Film and Digital Media here at the podcast. We stole Nathan from the Great White North. Nathan is a Canadian film and video artist who explores stories of redemption, ways of seeing, and what it means to be human. He specializes in documentary production. His films have screened at festivals and art galleries internationally. His teaching includes courses in screenwriting, film editing, multimedia storytelling, and his students' film projects have screened at national and international festivals, including the film Beyond the Margins, which has been used as promotional material by World Vision and UNICEF. His MFA thesis, Imago Dei, was nominated for the York University Thesis Prize. His artistry in film and reel can be followed on his website at www.nathanskolstad.com. So before we get to the interview, you recently sat down for an interview with Messiah's very own Ashley Schaefer.
So John, you completed graduate school in 1999, which, if you don't mind me saying, was largely a pre-digital age.
I'm an old man.
If you were to speak to your grad school self, what would he be most surprised about as you think about your scholarship and its various delivery modes today?
Right. Well, I obviously couldn't imagine blogging or social media when I was a graduate student finishing in 99. I actually got my first email account in 1994, my first year of graduate school. So I started with kind of email and went from there. So obviously I couldn't imagine then what I'm doing now online. But on the other hand, there's some continuity. I mean, I think I've always been a kind of traditional scholar too. I mean, I've written books, actual books that you can hold right in your hand. I've presented traditional papers at conferences, published in traditional journals. I've never taught an online course, and maybe I shouldn't say this with the provost sitting over there, but I hope I never get a chance to. So there's been some, you know, there's been some continuity between being a traditional scholar trained in the 90s, right, and what I continue to do as a historian. But social media, I think, provided an opportunity for me to expand my ideas, expand my writing. I think there's really a place, especially for faculty at Messiah College, a small, relatively small regional Christian college, to have your ideas put out there and actually in some cases even taken seriously in a way that may not necessarily always happen if you don't have the kind of Ivy League post or, you know, something like that. So yeah, I obviously couldn't imagine doing what I do now on social media, blogging, and so forth. But there's also, you know, I don't think I've changed too much in terms of this kind of scholarship I also value.
Sure, sure. And in terms of social media, you've been active on Twitter since 2012. Now, do you tweet as a historian, a social commentator, an educator? In other words, how do you think about your identity on Twitter?
Yeah, that's a great question. Twitter's like the wild, wild west. I should say this at the beginning. My identity on Twitter is very, very different from my identity as a classroom professor. I'm much more opinionated on Twitter. You know, I try to, as a historian, I try to present all sides, all views in my classroom. So, like, somebody who sees me on Twitter might say, you know, well, I don't agree with this guy. I never want to take a class with him. Or, oh, this guy's going to preach this certain political position or whatever. You know, I want to go to Messiah and, you know, take a course with him. So Twitter, to me, is a very different kind of delivery system, if you want to call it that, than the classroom is for me. I'm very traditional in the classroom. I've thought a lot about this question. You know, what's the difference between being a historian, a social commentator, an educator? I think I'm always an educator. That's in my DNA. So, you know, a lot of my tweets that I send out are usually links to things that I want people to consider, right? Here's an interesting way to think about a particular problem. And for me, I'm a historian, right? So a particular problem in the past. Right. Read this person. Read this woman's piece. Read this guy's piece. So in that sense, I'm always kind of trying to educate. Right. Most of my Twitter followers, I know there are academics who follow me on Twitter, but most of my Twitter followers are sort of Christians, pastors, graduate, a lot of graduate students and so forth. So, you know, I say it's the wild, wild west because if I commit sins on social media, they happen on Twitter, right? I go too far or I say something, I wish I wouldn't. I look at the next morning, so I wish I wouldn't have tweeted that and so forth. But really what I try to do is I try to engage current events with historical perspective. I mean, that's what, you know, I'm at my best when I'm doing that. I'm at my worst probably when I'm riffing on, you know, some kind of political issue or something, you know. So it's a... You know, it's a really, I don't know the answer, okay. How to separate those identities on Twitter.
Right. Well, right? And similar, yeah. So I've also followed you on Facebook, and I've noticed that your Facebook feed is a mix of posts about your latest episode of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, or updates on program proposals for the Faith and History Conference, or even your youngest daughter's 17th birthday, your oldest daughter's academic and athletic endeavors at Calvin. all of these things. So how do you balance your personal and professional aspects of your identity on your Facebook account?
Yeah, again, I'm glad that you're distinguishing between the different mediums, because I think about the different mediums differently. I have over 14,000 followers on Twitter. It's a very different kind of world. Facebook, obviously, you have to accept people into your community, right?
Sure.
You have to accept a friend request. I probably have about 100 friend requests just sitting there right now, and I'm not accepting them because I don't know. I mean, over the years, they build up, right? I don't know who these people are, and when I look at our common friends, I don't see a lot of common friends either. So I'm hesitant about sort of inviting them in to the conversation. Anyone who follows me on Facebook knows that the engagement, the conversation, the discussion about a particular issue is the most rigorous and intense there. You have more than 280 characters. People develop their thoughts. We argue about things. We debate things. And I want people there that I can trust to be sort of civil conversation partners. Not necessarily that I agree with them, but that they're going to, and you know, we get into some pretty intense arguments. But somebody who I can trust. Right. So I do. Having said that, I haven't figured Twitter out yet, or Facebook out yet, how to balance that, you know, family stuff.
Right.
Because on Facebook, I'm also, you know, want my mom to see that, you know, my daughter just graduated, or, you know, that she had a good game the other night or whatever. Some people have suggested I should have like a professional and a private one. I'm just not there yet. I'm still kind of thinking that all through. But I do think the people who follow my blog, do sort of appreciate, and then I invite into the Twitter circle. And it's not hard to get into it. I mean, if I know you, I'll accept your friend request. It's not like I've created this little exclusive kind of group.
Thank you for friending me.
Yeah, right. yes, but I think those people I can, you know, again, I can trust a little bit more, and I feel more comfortable kind of opening my family life to a limited extent to them. Yeah.
Well, and as you think about your strategy with social media, is there a time of day or a number of posts per day that inform your social media engagement and strategy? I mean, do you have a philosophy behind when you tweet or when you post on Facebook? And how do you decide when or when not to weigh in?
Yeah. Well, first, let me dispel a myth that I often hear sort of second, third hand, fourth hand from people. I'm constantly, you know, I blog, I put, you know, on a big day, I'll have like maybe 10 posts on my blog. I usually spend about 2 hours a night blogging. I rarely blog during the day. I rarely write a blog post. They're all scheduled. So, like, there's this misconception that I'm sitting there, you know, constantly at my computer all day. I write maybe 5, 4, 5, 6, 7 posts, depending on how I feel. When I'm done, I don't feel like writing anymore. I stop. And if you look at my blog, most of them are just links to other things that I say, here, this is cool, check it out, you know, or whatever. Or maybe give a 1 or 2 sentence opinion about the piece, or here's why it's important. And then they just go off. So, like, if you went on my blog right now, you'd see, you know, there's posts up there right now. How did he do that? You know, does he have a computer? Let me just dispel that myth. Having said that, I have seen my blog as part of my kind of vocational sort of calling as a sort of historian who wants to engage the public. So, you know, I do spend time on it every day. You know, sort of usually kind of later at night, preparing those posts for the next day. I find that at 9 p.m. on weeknights is when I get the most hits for some reason. So, all my posts go to Twitter at 9 o'clock. So, if you're following me on Twitter at 9 o'clock, you'll notice like all my posts are being, because the statistics show that's when most people are reading. So, it took me a while to figure all of that out. I will blog during the day if there's like, you know, my blog's about religion, politics, American history, so forth. So, if there's something breaking, right, you know, for me, something breaking would be, you know, like Donald Trump spoke at Liberty University, right? This intersection of politics or maybe Jimmy Carter spoke at Liberty University, right? This intersection of politics and religion, you know, I may want to respond in live time, right? So I might carve out some time during the day. But largely, they're sort of all scheduled, and that sort of makes my life a little more sane.
Oh, great, yeah. Great. Yeah. Well, and I'm so curious, you know, if you had to post one final tweet, what would it be?
Probably something, somebody please help me.
Call 911.
I got to give my colleague David Pettigrew credit for that one. You know, I asked him, what should I say for this question? And he gave me that answer. But it's true, you know.
Call for help.
Call for help, yeah.
Well, are there times in your life that you intentionally unplug from all things technology? And if so, when, why? Yeah.
Sure. I rarely blog. Like I said, I rarely blog during the day while I'm on campus and teaching, even when I'm at home, you know, if I'm at home doing writing that day or in the mornings or something. I rarely, if ever, use social media, produce things on social media from my phone. You know, so if I'm not at a computer or a laptop, I'm not engaged. I know that that's kind of strange for a lot of social media sort of people. Like, you don't do anything on your phone. Part of the thing, my hands are too big. I can't, you know, it's hard to, you know, I haven't figured out how to tweet like my daughters, you know, who can, it's like second nature. I actually just only started bringing my phone to work here on campus a year or two ago, because now Joy and I are down to one car. So we have to kind of, you know, you ready to go, you know, you know, kind of thing, so I can text her. Sometimes, too, I just get tired of the kind of fast-paced blogging. My philosophy of blogging comes from the conservative, he no longer blogs, but he's a conservative, moderate to conservative commentator, Andrew Sullivan, who had a blog called The Daily Dish. Mm. He was a full-time blogger. He would post every 15, 20 minutes. I obviously am nowhere near that, but that was always my model. So sometimes you get a little burned out and you sort of take a break. You know, I'll go on a blogging vacation for 2 weeks. But generally, I stay connected because, again, I feel, you know, I think, you know, well, I have enough followers and readers now that want to sort of hear, you know, want the information. They want, you know, they want to find out what's going on in the field of history. They want a take on something. And I do think it's a sense of vocation to stay digitally connected. The best way is to stay digitally connected to that kind of stuff. So, I don't see it as a hobby.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and switching gears a little bit, congratulations on the 10th anniversary of your book, The Way of Improvement Leads Home.
Thank you. It's
excellent. And your blog, and as well as the third year of your associated podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, can you walk us back in time and tell us what inspired you to launch The Way of Improvement Leads Home blog and then your podcast? Yeah.
The Way of Improvement Leads Home blog was started 10 years ago. My editor at the University of Pennsylvania Press, who published my first book, said, you know, we're talking about how to promote this thing, because it is an academic book, but I found there's an interesting story embedded in there. There's a romance in there. There's a love story in the book about this guy, Philip Vickers Vivian. And people seem to be connecting with this story amidst all the academic jargon kind of in between. So he said, why don't you start a blog? So I did. And if you go back and look at the beginning of The Way of Improvement Leads Home blog 10 years ago, you'll see a lot of the initial posts are like, and then Philip Vickers Vivian did this. And this is why on page 29, I decided to argue this, right? And in some ways, it's kind of boring, unless you were really into the book. But eventually it began to expand, and more people started reading. I started getting much more involved in kind of religion and politics, and bringing some kind of historical perspective to religion and politics, which I thought was a voice that wasn't out there that much. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it I don't want to say this was fast growth, you know. Right now, on a good day, we can get 5,000 readers a day at the blog. On a really good day, we've had as high as like 150,000 in a day if it's a really hot topic. Mm-hmm. On a bad day, you know, usually on the weekends, we get a couple thousand, which I think is still pretty good. So it's grown, and I think it's filled a gap for a lot of people who want kind of historical takes on what's going on in contemporary culture. The podcast, I guess it was about 3 years ago, one of my former students, Drew Hermeling, Drew Durley Hermeling, we used to go get coffee at Little Amps in Harrisburg, mm-hmm. not the big one, the little one, mm-hmm. Little neighborhood one. But we used to meet regularly, and we kind of had this idea. What if we started a podcast, right? We'll call it the Way of Improvement Leads Home Podcast. I needed someone who was digitally savvy. I'm really not. People say to me, like, you take up our, you know, digital stuff. I'm like, I'm not really that digital. I'm behind the curve. I know how to blog. Mm. Right? I mean, that's pretty much it, right? So Drew and I worked together. We got it started. History podcasts at the time were very, very popular. Since we started, we've done 4 seasons now. We've interviewed everybody from museum directors, Pulitzer Prize-winning historians. It's amazing. People just want to promote their ideas and their work. Hmm. So, you know, it's amazing. We just make these cold calls to people, emails, say, would you like to come on the podcast? Sure. You know, and we started in the radio station. Our producer, Josh Lowry, student producer Josh Lowry, some of you know him, he got us over into the studio here in Parmer, and we do it in there. And we started a Patreon campaign. I mean, Drew is way underpaid, but all the money that we raise, Patreon is a crowdfunding thing. So all the money that we make a month from our patrons goes directly to Drew. I make no money on it, and we pay our studio producer. The podcast started when two readers of longtime readers of the blog wanted to make a financial donation to help us start the podcast. And so that seed money is now pretty much gone, and we're now just relying on patrons to do that. I am so glad to be here with these 3 fine colleagues of mine at Messiah to talk about flourishing in a digital world. Let's just go from kind of my left to my right here. Let's start with you, David. Now, David, you've been on the podcast before. We did an actual much longer episode with David as a bonus episode for our patrons. So not everybody has heard this episode, but of course, if you want to become one of our patrons, you can go there and get the full episode. But so you've been here before. Tell me a little bit about you as your role as a digital historian and the way in which the Messiah College History Department has kind of embraced digital history. How does digital history shape your work, your teaching?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that when you guys hired me 12 years ago as your ancient historian, you were not thinking at all about digital history or my ability. And I think we've entered this environment, this world in which historians just start using technology and start to call themselves digital historians. But so much has changed in the last 20 years in our disciplines. Mm-hmm. You guys were talking about this earlier. I think I'm in the transition period between, you know, I'm in the just over 40 group here. And between you and between Drew, when I started graduate school at Ohio State, in the Ohio State University in 98, that's right.
Got a Buckeye in the crowd.
We have some Buckeyes. You know, I was still doing research the old-fashioned way. We'd go and pull Loeb classical texts off the bookshelf in the big reading room, try to find our citations for an ancient research topic physically, and then record it on note cards. Mm-hmm. And by the end of my time at Ohio State in 2006, I was using databases. I was using geographic information systems for my own research. I had a cell phone, so all of these things changed. Even that those little Loeb classical texts, that had all been digitized. So now you could search any Greek and Latin text just automatically. Even archaeology. So I'm an archaeologist, and even archaeology, which you think of, you know, the most common image is what? Indiana Jones, right?
Right.
So
and you're teaching an FYS on it.
Indiana Jones
in the title.
Indiana Jones and me, yes. So if you get rid of the guns and the whips and the Nazis, you're still left with this, like, you know, guy with the you know, person with a tiara hat.
You have the hat.
I have the hat. I do, and I have the whip. I don't have the Nazis or the spiders or the snakes, but. You're still left with this image of an archaeologist at a trench side, meticulously recording excavated material, stratigraphic context as it comes out of the ground. But actually, you're more likely, or as likely to see an archaeologist behind a computer screen these days studying artifact patterns, distribution patterns.
Let me interrupt for a second. Let me follow up on this. Because, you know, you are an accomplished archaeologist. You're an accomplished historian of the ancient world. You've published several books. You're editing in the big Oxford handbook right now on early Christian archaeology.
Yeah.
In what ways, and you started talking about this, but let me try to redirect you a little bit. In what ways does, the digital world now shape the way you work? I think you were starting to...
Everything.
But talk about this personally, in your own work in Cyprus.
Oh, sure. In 2011, we were excavating a Hellenistic site. So 3rd century BC, the age of Alexander the Great. Messiah College students are there, and Information Technology Services gave us 10 iPads to take along. We worked with a colleague at Washington and Jefferson University to develop an app, a digital app, where we recorded, instead of recording with physical notebooks, we recorded everything via an iPad app. At the end of the day, all of that data was uploaded to a server. And so you had this ongoing process of a backup. Next week, I'll be in ancient Corinth in Greece, and we'll be using drone photography to capture low-altitude, really high-resolution aerial photographs of the landscape.
Yeah.
And we hope to use that technology to see below the surface and to see things that we couldn't see otherwise.
Yeah.
Trench bottoms, right? Yeah, so there are lots and lots of examples of this, and we could also list them for other fields like history as well.
Now, you were joking about how, you couldn't imagine yourself being a sort of digital historian when we hired you.
Right.
We also couldn't imagine something called the Digital Harrisburg Project 12 years ago. And you have kind of had to become a kind of... 20th century United States historian too, right? To think about the digital. First of all, some of us may not be familiar. What is the Digital Harrisburg Project? You direct this project. Give us a kind of nutshell, kind of what you're doing. And then I know Gene can talk a little bit more about this too.
So the Digital Harrisburg, we actually call it an initiative because projects kind of start and then they're over and they have a limited span, and projects are usually one thing. So the initiative is a series of projects that is designed to tell the stories of Harrisburg with various kinds of digital technologies. We actually intentionally launched this in 2014 as part of a collaboration here on campus with Jeff Erickson's GIS class, with Jim LeGrand's public history class, and then off campus with Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. We partnered to do some historical mapping of the city of Harrisburg 120 years ago. Harrisburg, those in the audience who don't know Harrisburg's history, has an interesting City Beautiful movement that transforms the city overnight. The green spaces, the Capitol, state capitol building, the buildings around the state capitol, the Riverwalk, all of those are part of the City Beautiful movement. Major change, but it was also socially disruptive, social disruptive movement. It knocked out the old Eighth Ward, the city's most ethnically and racially diverse neighborhood in the 19-teens. And so we're trying to understand how this happened. And so what we did is we put the entire population of the city on the map. We worked with census tables and our digital history students, I assigned them data entry in my digital history class, and each of them had 2,000 records of the federal census, but it turns out students don't like data entry.
That's right.
I learned it the hard way with a mutiny in the class.
That's right.
But a pretty cool product at the end of the day, and we're doing lots of other things at this point.
As your chair, I've read those goldenrod sheets.
They have improved over time.
This is a nice transition into Gene. Gene, you, as many of you know, Gene directs our Center for Public Humanities here. And you run a program called Poetry in Place that's also connected with the Digital Harrisburg Project. So tell us a little bit, what is Poetry in Place, and then how is Poetry in Place connected to sort of the Digital Harrisburg work that David and his team, and I assume you're part of that team as well, are doing?
Well, I will say, so actually 2014 was also the first year of the student fellows.
That's
so
right.
David and I have worked together the entire time connecting the work of the center to Digital Harrisburg. And in some ways, you're still operating as an archaeologist because you're peeling through the layers of culture, right?
It's Indiana Jones.
Yeah. I always wanted to go with Indiana Jones somewhere, so that this is almost as good as going to Greece. I don't know. So Poetry in Place is one of the projects. We've actually, the fellows have been involved with Digital Harrisburg in some way. Mm-hmm. David likes to say that I'm about getting the social history of Harrisburg, which I think that's true, and that's what I'm interested in. But we've been doing this since 2014, and I thought David was going a little too slow for me. I thought that he was going
to... Why doesn't that surprise me?
I know. and he's very careful about that data entry, which is very good that he is, because you can rely on what you're finding. And he started a little bit too far back in history for me as well. But after 4 years, this year I feel like was the first time we really found our stride in. It has been such careful, detailed work that the students have had to do. So I really appreciate, I emailed Rachel Carey, who was there 4 years ago, mm-hmm. to say, listen, we are so grateful for all that data entry you did. Yeah. And I think once students can see how people really can use it and it can make, it makes things accessible and it allows people to see things that they couldn't have seen before. David taught the Hoverter students this semester. The Hoverter students is a class for non-traditional students. The youngest one is 20, the oldest one 74. I love them, how they came alive when David would show them the maps and they could kind of find their bearings. And they kept on saying, we never knew this history.
And this was a specific class on
Harrisburg
history of Harrisburg.
Yeah. And they actually have created some blog posts that mm-hmm. they can contribute to the Digital Harrisburg. But Poetry in Place is another, it's a collaboration with middle school. Well, it's all ages, high school and middle school students in Harrisburg. And it started in 2014 as well. But the goal is to connect Harrisburg students to the rich cultural and social and historical history that is Harrisburg that often they are not connected to. And so this year has been the first year we've really found ways to connect to the Digital Harrisburg Project and really, I think, energizing and flourishing ways, if you will. But Poetry in Place, this year we wrote poetry our theme was Civil War to Civil Rights because of Martin Luther King's 50th anniversary of his assassination. And we went to memorials in the city, but the most exciting Poetry in Place workshops we did was around the old 8th Ward. And so we used the information that David's students.
Yeah.
David really didn't do much data entry at all. So David's students. But we used their maps and one Poetry in Place workshop, we went to the Capitol complex and we took the map for the current complex and overlaid the 1910 map and we had one of the fellows had little cards that she created out of the census data that everybody had a card for every person, and we would read the people's names when we got to Cranberry Street or when we get, mm-hmm. and sometimes we forgot people's streets and they got very upset.
So these were displaced residents. Yeah,
displaced residents. So it would be, our favorite was John Spotwood. John Spotwood was a barber. That's the name I remember most. But anyway, so they would read their names, and then they would find each other's neighbors. So we were in real life using that digital data. And then we went back, and as we were writing the workshop, writing the poetry, we had all they've spent so much time scanning pictures from the archives, and we put them up on washer clotheslines all over the place so they could walk around and find their street and find the pictures on their street. So it was really, really rich. Yeah. And their poetry was so historical. They, I mean, it wasn't even a history assignment for them, but it was very.
And when you talk about archives, we've also developed a relationship with the Dauphin County Historical Society there in Harrisburg. So we've built that relationship. Yeah. We get access to their archives. Tell me, Gene. You know, you are.
Can I tell you one more thing about that archive thing? Because this was most exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
The last poetry workshop was "I Dream a World." We did we did Martin Luther King, and then and that was fabulous. But then "I Dream a World," and they wrote poems about for the time capsule that's in front of St. Stephen's Church, and it's going. Their poems are going to be in the archives.
Wow!
So they handed their poems over to David Carmichael to put in the archives for that.
You also teach writing. Right? So you've been involved in writing pedagogy over the years. Can you tell us about the ways in which we might think about writing instruction as it's related to all of these digital issues, the digital world?
Well, obviously the poetry and plays, they are writing. And my students actually in my ethnic lit class use the resources for their work too. But I think the three big things about writing in a digital world, I'm teaching writing for social change in the fall, and how can you teach writing for social change without thinking about the available means for you in a digital world? I mean, social change happens when people figure out how to use digital platforms effectively, so that has to be a big part of it. But also, I think just, you know, as a heuristic. The digital world offers so many available means to us as writers. So it expands our imagination, first of all, as writers. It expands our ways of thinking about audiences and possible audience, which is a very important part of our writing pedagogy at Messiah, is writing for purpose and writing for audience, and they can write for real audience. We have both the Digital Harrisburg and the Center for Public Humanities has a blog. Students write and rewrite and rewrite with audience in mind for those blogs. Mm-hmm. But also, you can write multimodal essays. You don't have to have just written text, so they can think of composing in a more integrated way. And also, it does really create access, I think. So,
great. Thank you, Gene. And Nathan's been quiet down there. you are a digital storyteller. Is that fair? To some extent, right? You use multimedia stories to spur people to action, right? And in some ways, we heard a little bit about the kind of activism as well here from Gene. You've produced an award-winning film, Beyond the Margins, which has been used for promotional material, which has been used as promotional material by World Vision and UNICEF. I guess I have a sort of, you know, well, first of all, tell us a little bit about those films. Let's get that out there.
Sure. Yeah. So Beyond the Margins was a film that working with the collaboratory at Messiah College, so housed in the engineering program. The engineering program at Messiah does fantastic work all over the world. We're engaging our students in actually like being in the field, producing materials that matter for people's lives. So in this case, some of the work they were doing was in Ghana, where they were working on water, sanitation, hygiene issues. And they'd already put in a lot of work there that had improved people's lives. But the next step in that was they looked at it and they said, what about people with disabilities? Can they access these resources as their design? So they went back and they were kind of looking at how could we make this more inclusive? So then Rodney Green, who was the program manager at the time with the collaboratory, came to me and our department and said, hey, we'd like to make a film or a commercial, something along those lines to kind of document what's going on there. And so then we pulled in a student, Derek Esch, he's graduated, but a former student, and we looked at the project and we said, okay, when you're not being paid for commercial work, you have more flexibility. So you can kind of say, I'm not going to do it the way that you would normally do it and the way you want it. What we're going to do is we're going to look at, well, what is this thing really about? So what's the story behind it? Because I could go and Derek could go and he could just film and say, look at these Messiah College students putting in water. Isn't that great?
Right.
And it is great. Like that, I'm not disputing whether that's great or not. What I'm disputing is, well, who is this for? And what is the point of this? And how does this change their lives and their sense of identity, humanity? Mm-hmm. And if this is about creating access, then let's look at the lives of these people with disability who have been kind of on the margins of their society and give them, help us to more broadly understand, whether it's in Ghana or here, that it's not just about, oh, we've made their lives better. It's about that when they're included in our society, they are part of us and we're more whole when we do that. So we told their story and we showed world, you saw at one point that World Vision was involved. But other than that, we didn't say this is a World Vision project.
Right,
and
right.
We just told these people's stories. And that had a lot of impact. So World Vision looked at that and they continue to use it. UNICEF's been using it because it makes people aware of the lives, the stories, the impact. It's not saying, hey, we went in and we fixed this. It's, this is what this means for people.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. Did you get to meet Meghan Markle when you were working for World Vision? I know she's an ambassador. Just kidding. Sometimes we have to throw little jokes in to keep our podcast listeners. That was a pretty bad one.
I wasn't judging, but...
You teach digital media. Mm-hmm. Now, for someone who has really no knowledge of this field, what's the difference between digital media and non-digital media? Is there a...
Sure.
Isn't all media in this day and age digital? Is there such a thing as non-digital media anymore?
Right. Yeah.
When Drew
says, oh, it's just the world, right?
right.
Well, yes and no. So, we can begin to kind of look at it and say, well, a lot of digital media is just a translation of this analog form. So it's digital photography, it's digital graphic design. Like, mm-hmm. but for me, it's like, okay, well, I'm a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So a lot of the times I'm not going to distinguish there between which tool I use. Yes, the tool shapes how I produce it, and it kind of changes my way of thinking about it and what I can collect and capture. It changes budgets. It changes all kinds of things related to approaches. So documentary filmmakers are always kind of pushing technology because it creates access. It creates new ways of telling these stories. So on the one hand, you have this sense where it's just like this kind of traditional Western Gnostic breakdown of like, well, is that really different? It's like, oh, well, body and spirit, and like we just like to separate things. But there is a sense where digital media is really different. So I would say, I mean, Marshall McLuhan's kind of important, being really prophetic and kind of looking at this and saying, electric media is different than the mechanical media because as light... It travels at the speed of light, mm-hmm. and it can be constant. And it's kind of changing the speed and fragmenting the way that we exist in society. So on one level, these are all just extensions of our senses. Mm-hmm. But digital media, because it's so based in computation, you have someone like Lev Manovich who would say, okay, yeah, it's not just a translation, but these computers make a huge difference in that they can... they become interactive. So thinking about interactivity and how we create those experiences. So I can make a film with digital materials and it could just be a film and there's nothing that really changes. Or I can create an experience for someone that says, you need to come in, you're going to interact with this piece, I'm going to create new spaces for this piece. The computer might even change the experience. And that happens on like micro levels and then it happens on more ways I can control that and kind of engage mm-hmm. with it mm-hmm. differently. So database, even.
Yeah.
So documentary filmmakers, I mean, the access of what we have and what we can distribute.
Yeah. So digital media is not necessarily an oxymoron, or it's not necessarily redundant.
It's not, like we
historians like to say, like, there's no such thing as revisionist history because all history is revisionist, right? It's redundant to say revisionist history. Digital media is...
I think it depends on your approach, because a screen is different, because screen changes over time. And it, sometimes we can control it, and sometimes it will move at the pace that somebody's designed it to move at.
What, as you think about the future, Nathan, what would be some important things that our audience, both our live audience, they're still here, and our podcasting audience, what are some important things that can help us for all of our students to sort of thrive in a digital age? Any quick kind of quick kind of thoughts on that, right?
Okay, so maybe I'll try three quick ones. Okay, so I think...
Three bullet points, yeah.
Yeah, so we have to teach our students practical things. Practical, like, this is the tool, this is how you use it, and we sometimes, I would like to blow past that. at times. But we can't, because, I mean, it's really important just to understand what the tools are and how to use them in order to do your job. So you're a Springsteen fan. Bruce Springsteen talks about, like, what is his work as a musician? And he would say, I'm like a plumber. Like, I'm just trying to fix the world in small ways every day.
Yeah.
And so what our work, so I have to teach people how to use that wrench. Mm-hmm. If otherwise, this wasn't very helpful. And I have to show them how to approach these different problems of why you'd use this wrench versus that wrench and why you, just in that basic way. But then I would say, well, what do I actually do as an educator at a liberal arts college? I teach people to care. Like, that is my job. It's to teach people to pay attention to the world and to care about the things that God cares about, to love your neighbor as yourself. So if I do that, then if I do those two things, then I've won.
Yeah.
And then I would say, kind of, well, you know, what's the last piece to the equation? Are you willing to change? Because so much we think about, oh, I'm going to change my students. I'll have 4 years with them, and I will change them.
Of course, they will be
great mirror images of me. It will be amazing. Just like we make God in our image, I will make them in my image, and won't the world be great? Or am I willing to change? Like, we think we have all the answers, and will I change with them? Will they change me? Will I? Every time I make a film, the people I make films with, they change me. Mm-hmm. And they should. And if I'm not doing that, and if I'm not on that course, then I think I've lost the plot.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah,
jump
right
in.
One thing I appreciate about both these guys is they are willing and flexible, and I have thrown huge wrenches in their classes before because I said I had an idea, and they ran with it, and and they were so gracious. And they still speak to me. but I do think this, I think what is most exciting about, I think, the work that we do, and we're all on the Digital Humanities Committee together, is this site for cross-disciplinary work together. And so I do think if you are holding on pretty tight to the class that you developed 10 years ago, and you're not really willing to rework that a little bit, because it does, and you're not willing to get a few bad evaluations along the way. It is risky, right? Wouldn't you say? But I've been so appreciative of both of these guys in terms of, they've been willing to say, hey, that is a project that would.
The other thing I picked up in this conversation. It strikes me that you're all doing kind of very kind of face-to-face, you're integrating kind of very face-to-face kind of community kind of projects with the digital, right? You know, you're not off in some kind of, digital world that's disconnected.
The digital world is disconnected, like it's disincarnate.
Right.
But actually, well, on one sense it is, but actually it asks us to be more incarnational. It asks us to be in the world and engage. Like, it's not, sure, I can reach out to a whole bunch of people, but I would say digital tools actually let me access my community. They let me be in my community. And again, not just so I can, like, do my research, but actually so I can serve and be served by the people in my community.
Yeah. How else would you respond to sort of a critic who would say, let me give you a quick example. I've been involved in this little website tussle because I sometimes will tweet about one of my favorite novelists, Wendell Berry, who's very place-centered, and the hardcore Berry disciples are saying, it's just so strange to tweet about Wendell Berry. Like, you're not, you know, you've sold your soul kind of thing. How do you respond to those kinds of critics? Who would say, you know, the digital kind of, you know, I was joking about never having to teach an online course. I hope I don't have to, right? How do you respond to that kind of criticism of the digital? I mean, you've all thought about this a lot more than I have.
Yeah, I think you respond by saying you have the right, we should be critical, right? We should be critical of the digital world that we live in. We should ask the kinds of questions that, you know, some of the questions that Janelle was asking earlier. And circumspect, one of the things that I haven't started encouraging my students to think about within the digital history class is digital minimalism. Mm-hmm. Right? So you...
Define that, yeah.
So it's basically choosing the things that actually give your life value, mm-hmm. right? Minimalism. So embracing less so that you can have more. And so what are the minimum number of digital tools that you can use which are going to open up, which are going to give you the most value? So reducing the noise, intentionally reducing the noise, going with less, reducing the number of tools, and really digging in to things that you couldn't do otherwise, you know, that make it possible to do a new kind of research or to teach in a different way that change mm-hmm. the way students think about the questions, but not doing everything. So I think the critiques have got to be there, right? I think that's an important part of this conversation.
Yeah. There's things you have to say no to, and Sabbath is really important in that concept. And I mean, like, if I want to see better, I close my eyes more. Mm-hmm. If I want to hear better, I turn down the noise in my life. So if you want to be able to do the work we do, you can't just be on all the time. That's not how God designed us to be.
I turn to David sometime during the semester, and I said, this is our big so what, is that it has to be very recursive, digital, real, back and forth. I think the students that are doing data entry, they have to connect it to Harrisburg, the real world. Mm-hmm, they have to mm-hmm. be in there. And I think it raises their care factor when they go back. Don't you? I think it really does in terms
Absolutely.
Of... And when they begin to have real people really touching their work as well. Yeah. But also, we really got to march around the Capitol complex, but the digital made it possible for us to imagine what it was like in ways that those students never would have had. And it also pushed them into digital research and allowed them to see these different opportunities to find information. So,
now, I'm guessing a lot of the audience here, our live audience here at the Messiah Faculty Community of Educators, and our podcast listening audience, you know, I'll give you each a minute. You have each 1 minute. I'm going to cut you off after a minute. Cynthia's timing down here. Maybe everyone's on their own kind of, you know, on their own kind of phase of their digital journey, right, so to speak. Let's just say someone wants to kind of maybe stick a toe in the water or a foot in the water or dive in, right? Give us one kind of practical way of kind of getting engaged with the digital world as academics, as people who want to be engaged with the community. Just give us one little, I know this wasn't on our script, right? But one little tip, right? You know, you have a minute to tell me a tip or tell us a tip.
Go.
Anybody, we don't have to go in order.
Well,
I stumped them, I think.
No. I pitched this to the School of Humanities. I said, if you had to do one little digital assignment for your class, and you're interested in writing, and you're interested in students doing some critical thinking, have them start a WordPress site. Have them start a little website.
What is a WordPress site?
So WordPress is a platform for building blogs and websites. They're very easy to set up. It's not just a blog, it's a dynamic website.
I'm looking at Cynthia.
You get to see the...
Oh, you have 30
seconds. You can see the HTML, you can see the code, and you can learn to write for a public audience. And doing that is, I think, a good experience because it changes the way that you think about audience. It changes the style of the writing. It's a different kind of writing.
Yeah.
So that's mine.
If we had more time, I'd love to talk about how to use WordPress blogs and so forth in classes and so forth, but that may be for another conversation. Who's up next?
Yeah, okay. I think that one of the things with digital media is that it allows us to engage all of our senses, right? So in that sense, it's more fully human, or it's helping mm-hmm. us to, like, rather than a book is helping me to think really rationally and engage with my eyes. So multimedia allows us to have all of these experiences, so it can be emotion and idea at the same time. Mm-hmm. And again, time and space and composites. So maybe something you do with your students can try to engage all of those. So think more creatively about a paper. And we kind of go to the traditional, well, it's just a blog now, it's just this. And that's just, again, like a digitizing sometimes mm-hmm. of the paper. Like, it's no different. but maybe there's a way for it to integrate these senses, like here are the sounds from the place, and this plays at the same time as you read the words of this person, and here now you can look at their journal article. So if you design that multimedia experience, that might take me more into what it's like to be this person.
Great. Jean?
Well, I will say, I did a website for Central Pennsylvania Literary History a few years ago in a class, and you cannot do a lot of content and the digital, it takes up time, mm-hmm. so you really have to figure out how to frame it, and it has to be, you have to really think through assessment because students are so anxious, so figuring out how to create assessment that brings the anxiety down and allows them to take risks, I think is an important part of it as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming to Educators Day today and enlightening us and for being guests on our first live episode of the podcast. Let's, again, live studio audience, let's give them a big hand.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
So I'd say that was a success.
What do you think, Drew?
Well, I was just
did back. We survive our first live episode?
I think we did. I was just backstage retweeting Community of Educator Devin Manzullo Thomas about the podcast
okay.
episode.
So give me a quick takeaway.
Oh, well, I thought that on the spot. So what I really think is valuable from this particular conversation is the ways in which digital media brings us together into one conversation while at the same time pulling at different strands that are unique to our particular disciplines, right? Yeah. So we saw here three educators from three different departments really having one conversation, and I think that right. is in many ways, that's the thing that gets me most excited as someone in grad school who's looking into the future of my own career as an educator.
Yeah, and you know, as somebody who knows a little bit about the digital world, but not as much as these panelists over here, you know, there's always things to learn. You know, I'm thankful for these colleagues and all the colleagues who are engaged in these digital things. I learned so much from them.
I did notice you asked Dr. Pettigrew, what's a WordPress site? You know your website is a WordPress site,
I do
right?
know that. Okay. I do know.
As the person who set it up for you, I want you to know that.
I switched from Blogger to WordPress okay. when you came on
I'm
board.
The one who told you to do that. All right.
That's why I did it. Yeah, I did know how to ask that question. So again, Drew, this has been, a great episode. I guess that's a wrap.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a real treat for our listeners. It's a bonus summer episode, but I'm really thankful that we got to have all of
Let's
our
Let's hear the live studio audience
Thank
one
you.
More time. We are going to do our sort of digital, you are going to do your sort of digital magic, editing magic on this episode, and when do you think it'll drop? I know I'm putting you on the spot again.
I can get this done in 2 weeks.
Okay, so look for this episode in sometime in June, maybe?
Yeah,
early June?
Early June.
Good. So thank you again for listening. And as always, may your way of improvement always lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out the other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice so others may more easily find this podcast. And let's continue this conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. This bonus episode was brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, and Ron Schooler. Additionally, this episode received extra generous support from the Office of the Provost at Messiah College. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. This podcast was recorded in front of a live studio audience at the High Center of Messiah College. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guests, David Pettigrew, Gene Corey, and Nathan Skolstad, and to our guest artistic producer, Cynthia Wells. Our guest interviewer was Ashley Schaefer. Our sound engineers today are Jonathan Burt and Derek Malden.
I've been your producer, Drew Durley Hermeling, and your host has been, as always, John Fia.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.